Latin Music Fest 2024, 16th anniversary edition, will be held at Majestic this year on Wednesday, November 27th. The Latin Music Fest, Madison's annual Big Salsa Night, will feature Grupo Candela, Charanga a Goza, and the Tony Castañeda Latin Jazz Super Band. Also on board is DJ Francis Medrano. And this year, Latin Music Fest has selected Richard Hilner Armakanki as Latin Musician of the Year. The Latin Music Fest 2024 is on Wednesday, November 27th, Eve of Thanksgiving at Majestic. Doors at 7, show at 8 p.m. This is Listener Sponsor Radio, WORT 89.9 FM in Madison.
BBC News with Sue Montgomery. The Supreme Court in India has ruled against the practice of demolishing the homes of those accused of crimes, which activists say disproportionately targets Muslims. Our South Asia regional editor Anbarasa Natarajan told us more.
Demolition of illegal houses or buildings are common in many parts of the world, but in India in the last few years, it has taken a different dimension, with the human rights groups accusing some of the states governed by the Hindu nationalist BJP of targeting the minority Muslim community, destroying their houses and businesses. Now the court has come out very categorically saying that demolition of such houses and properties of individuals accused of any crime or even convicted of crime is unconstitutional.
Joe Biden is hosting Donald Trump in the White House today, honouring a tradition between the outgoing and incoming presidents that Mr. Trump did not accord to Mr. Biden when the roles were reversed 4 years ago. Our correspondent in Washington, Gary O'Donoghue, told us the meeting could be frosty.
And the last time they came face to face, President Biden called him a convicted felon with the morals of an alley cat. And Donald Trump basically accused him of being senile, President Biden. So, yeah, I mean, it's going to be awkward. I think there's no doubt about that. But when Donald Trump did actually go to the White House during the transition from President Obama in 2016, he was incredibly polite about the whole thing. So there may not be the public fireworks you see today. And we'll see how long he stays there. I think it'll be an indication of whether they got into any substance.
Experts at the COP summit in Azerbaijan have for the first time discussed the climate impact of jet condensation trails. Their impact on global warming could be as big as that caused by fossil fuels in aviation. From the summit, here's our environment correspondent, Matt McGrath.
Contrails form in the sky in the same way that your breath turns misty on a cold morning. Exhaust from airplane engines condenses into a white vapour in the right atmospheric conditions. Wild conspiracy theories have grown up around contrails, with some believing they contain chemical or biological agents that could spread disease or control people's minds. These ideas are all untrue. The dangerous reality is that long-lasting contrails can make the climate impact of flying much worse. However, the issue can be solved by rerouting a small number of airplanes, all for a cost of around $5 a flight.
Police in Mozambique have fired tear gas to disperse protesters in the capital Maputo as tensions rise across the city. The opposition leader, Venancio Mondlane, has called for a three-day nationwide protest targeting regional capitals, ports and borders. BBC News.
Are you a fan of local music? Looking to hear some fresh new tunes? Join us on the 89.9 FM WORT Access Hour Monday, November 18th at 7 p.m. for an exclusive live performance by Smart Cookie, Madison's newest R&B pop band, who will be playing their fun and danceable tunes to get you moving and grooving. Featuring funky grooves, catchy hooks, and conscious lyrics, lose yourself in the rhythms of Smart Cookie's groove-based music and let the beats and melodies inspire you. This is not just any band, it's an experience. And we've got them live right here just for you. So mark your calendars, tell your friends, and get ready to turn up the volume. This is a local music party you don't want to miss. And it's only here on the 89.9 FM WORT Access Hour.
The WORT Board of Directors will hold its regularly scheduled meeting on Wednesday, November 20th at 6 p.m. in person at the station, 118 South Bedford Street. The public is welcome to attend. Meeting attendance is also available via Zoom. For information on how to attend this meeting virtually, please email president@wortfm.org.
Do you care about workers and labor issues? Do you want to make a difference in our community for working people? Then join the Labor Radio team. Labor Radio is a weekly show that covers labor, social justice, and political issues that impact workers. And we need your help. As a Labor Radio volunteer, you will have the opportunity to report on important labor and social justice stories in your community, interview workers, activists, and experts, produce and edit your own stories. No prior experience is necessary, though a connection with labor is a plus. We will provide training and support. All you need is a passion for worker justice and a desire to amplify the voices of working people. To learn more, contact Volunteer Coordinator Adrian Rainey at 608-321-9583 or head online to wortfm.org/volunteer to fill out an application. Labor Radio, a voice for workers.
Good morning. It is Wednesday, November 13th, and this is the 8 o'clock buzz. I'm Jan Miyasaki. This morning, I'll be speaking with Chris Mills Rodrigo, a managing editor at inequality.org at the Institute for Policy Studies. And I wanted to talk with him about the latest issue of the weekly newsletter. The inequality.org editorial team says, and I'm accepting here, we'll save you our postmortem on the election and stick to what we know. Inequality's tendrils are wrapped all over this election. And we believe that an anti-inequality agenda focusing on limiting wealth concentration and improving conditions for those our top-heavy capitalism tosses aside still remains clearly popular. So now comes the hardest part, they say. Building a movement that can fight for significantly greater equality amid a looming fascist threat. So stay tuned to hear from Chris Mills Rodrigo. Also in the newsletter, though, there was some good news amidst the darkness, a few bright spots in the fight against inequality. Washington State beats back efforts to repeal a capital gains tax and a payroll tax that funds long-term care insurance, and Illinois voters showed support for a tax hike on millionaires, and three red states passed paid leave. So there you go. Stay tuned to hear from Chris. We also want to talk about lessons from Europe with him. The left can't win by running to the right, so sticking to a principled position can pay off electorally. So stay tuned for that conversation. And I'm happy to welcome back Dr. Clarence Lussain later this morning. He was with me day one after the election, and today, 1 week later, Dr. Clarence Lussain is a professor of political science and director of the International Affairs Program at Howard University and an independent expert to the European Commission against racism and intolerance. And I want to talk with him about white nationalism in the U.S. and in Europe and pushing back on right-wing movements. So stay tuned to the program. We'll be right back.
The high yellow moon
12 minutes after 8, and joining me is Chris Mills Rodrigo, Managing Editor at inequality.org at the Institute for Policy Studies. And the latest issue, the weekly newsletter of inequality.org, the editorial team says, we'll save you our post-mortem on the election and stick to what we know. Inequality's tendrils are wrapped all over this election. We believe that an inequality agenda focused on limiting wealth concentration and improving conditions for those our top-heavy capitalism tosses aside still remains deeply popular. Now comes the hard part, building a movement that can fight for significantly greater equality amid a looming fascist threat. And, you know, listeners, I would just urge you to log on to this newsletter. It is a go-to newsletter for me. Good morning, Chris. Thanks for joining me.
Thanks. Good morning. And thank you for the kind words about the newsletter.
Yeah. Hey, Chris, I'm going to, you know, I was thinking about you all there. And I think of your team because our listeners are familiar with your team. Go-to people I talk with. Listeners are Sam Pizzagatti, Chuck Collins, Sarah Anderson, Omar Ocampo, and Chris Mills Rodrigo. And Chris, I thought of you because I'm thinking about the generational change as well, and the work ahead for you. And so when the team came together, and this is a really great team, can you kind of give us some insight into what you guys were thinking about as you prepared for your next issue?
Totally. I mean, I think we all, you know, had the possibility open that Donald Trump would be reelected, but I think there was a moment of sort of being taken aback by the margins by which he was reelected and sort of the dominant performance of Republicans in House and Senate races now that we know that both chambers are going Republican. So I think it was, you know, take a moment, think what has gone wrong, and, you know, what can our role be in trying to forge the movement that you were talking about earlier, you know, a broad-based movement that fights against inequality. So what we tried to do was look around for bright spots in the election, and we found a couple. Minimum wage legislation that was passed by voters in Missouri and Alaska, you know, two red states that frequently vote Republicans, but decided to pass legislation that would help, you know, the lowest rungs of workers. Similarly, in Nebraska, a piece of paid leave legislation passed with over 70% support. So, you know, was looking at those things, looking at what remains popular, and trying to think about how you can build a party, a campaign that centers those economic issues. And, you know, takes into account the way people feel. I think there was, you know, a feeling throughout the Biden administration that there was policy that was being implemented that would have positive economic effects in the long term. Thinking stuff like the Inflation Reduction Act, the CHIPS Act, you know, broad industrial policy that would inject money back into American businesses and the economy. But there was a sort of a failure to connect those policies to the way people were feeling and a failure to effectively communicate what that strategy of industrial policy meant. Also, you know, I don't want to spend too much time nitpicking how the administration handled this. I think there was, you know, sort of a shift away from that economic populist message after the first year's administration. But that aside, you know, trying to think about how we can communicate positive policy developments in ways that get people excited and people wanting to vote. So, you know, one important thing for us was trying to shift away from a sort of defensive, you know, this is what the administration, the incoming administration is going to do that's bad, and more to a positive, here's what the future could look like if we're able to win the sort of reforms that we're looking for. And, you know, here's where that money could go. Public services that could be expanded, access to education that could be expanded, and yeah, trying to just present a vision of what America could look like when extreme wealth inequality is tackled.
This article, there's this newsletter, you know, and it's a quick read, you know, takes time, but you can get through it, listeners, and then there's articles to follow up with. And, you know, it reminds us and tells us that it's really going to be work on the local and state levels. And when you were talking about the amidst this darkness, there were some bright spots. That's, you know, what was going on and was what you were largely referencing. And I wanted to talk about, just quickly, there's this 2022 Washington State 7% excise tax on capital gains on the sale of stocks and bonds and those types of financial things, except for real estate. And that generated a whole lot of income, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. A huge sum of money for the state, so much so that a lot of moneyed interests got together and put a ballot proposal on the platter for Washington voters to remove that capital gains tax, and it was defeated, which I think is a really strong sign that, you know, once people get progressive taxation legislation, they're interested in keeping it around.
A 7% excise tax on this kind of financial dealings over $250,000, excluding real estate, in 2 years raised $1.3 billion. And that money being used in childcare, early learning, public schools, school rehab, construction, those sorts of things. And it survived. Attempts to call it back. So it's really going to, like all things, be something that happens at the grassroots.
Absolutely. And you can see, you know, other examples of state legislation that was driven by, you know, grassroots activism, like in Massachusetts, the Fair Share Amendment that adds a tax on a 4% surtax on annual incomes over $1 million. Which was able to bring in $2.2 billion in its first full year of implementation, much of which went toward transportation and education. And this is, you know, a case of folks getting together in a state and deciding, you know, we're a little tired of the, you know, reticence of the federal system to move. We're just going to implement a tax in our state, and it's been working very well.
You know, Chris Mills Rodrigo, when I follow what you're writing when you're looking at Europe and what kind of movements and particularly some right-wing gains there. And I wanted to talk with you about, and especially as you as a younger person, you write about lessons from Europe. The left can't win by running to the right. You talk about a united front and sticking to principles. Can we just talk about what those principles are to push back against this kind of right-wing agenda?
Yeah, I think sort of what I was mentioning earlier about presenting a vision of the future and then sticking with it, I think a failure of sort of center-left and liberal parties both here and in Europe recently has been to kind of hew to whatever parts of popular right-wing policies they can adopt. So that's especially been present in immigration, where you have a bunch of parties in Europe, you know, kind of adopting what the right wing won on half a decade ago of, you know, we need to make a more exclusionary Europe, that we need to control refugee flows. And then here in the United States as well, where you have the Democratic Party essentially saying that for years was saying that Donald Trump's border wall was the worst thing possible, shifting toward taking credit for it because they've seen that people do feel, you know, strongly about immigration. I think when you have a more, you know, principled party that has a vision of the future, instead of just sort of being reactionary to saying, well, look, people care about the border, we should just, you know, say that we're going to close it down, I think it gives you the opportunity to think, well, how does this, you know, interact with our morals, with our ethical positions about, you know, the fact that all people have rights and that all people deserve to be able to, you know, live a better life. And from that point, you can then present, you know, a positive vision of immigration, reminding people that not only the United States, but countries all over the world are greatly benefited by immigration, not only just for cultural diversity, which, I mean, I think is one of America's, you know, best parts, but also economically. I mean, there is very compelling evidence that immigrants are contributing to economies by, you know, working a lot of jobs. They also do, you know, pay taxes despite what the right says. So, and I'm just using the example of immigration here, but it's when you have a guiding ideology, it makes it much easier to respond to problems in positive ways rather than just in reactionary ways.
You know, you observe the messaging here and the messaging in other parts of the world, and particularly in Europe. Now, how do you push back against that messaging? Can you just say more about that? I know that you can't be reactionary, like you say. We should be on the offensive and not the defensive. Can you say more about that?
Well, it's tough. I think one of the big takeaways from the early exit polling, so to take it with a grain of salt, is that a lot of people in the United States, and this is true in Europe as well, folks that tend to vote for right-wing parties also tend to have kind of skewed beliefs about how the economy is doing, or like what the impact of the climate crisis is, or what the impact of immigrants are. So I think, taking the time to process what motivates people, why they're, at the point where they want a sort of a strong man, someone to fix their problems. And then being able to articulate why your positions, why your ideology, is a better way to improve living conditions. I think people all over the world are struggling with very similar problems, high rent, difficulty getting into the job market. Even when they are in the job market, jobs are pretty miserable. And this isn't, exactly to your point, but I think one issue that's been brought up a lot is that there were incumbents losing all over the world in these past couple election cycles, mostly because of the inflation that occurred because of, COVID supply shocks that was kind of out of the hands of politicians, but then got blamed on them. I think there's a very interesting counterpoint out there. That's Mexico, where a pretty unabashedly left-wing socialist administration was able to stay in power because it was able to explain why why inflation, wasn't their fault, and why their policy positions were actually a better way to tackle sort of the manifestations of inflation. I think sometimes politicians get a little bit too focused up on, the idea of inflation, but not sort of the material consequences of going to the store and not being able to afford the same groceries you did earlier, or it being harder to treat yourself to a night out in the town. So I think, looking at people's motivations, understanding why people feel the way that they feel, the way that gets them voting for demagogues, and then being able to articulate why your policies, why your ideology is a better solution to that. I know it's a little bit broad. It's difficult
to summarize it all,
but I think that is the sort of messaging strategy that we should be pursuing.
And you could just observe, I thought I could observe, this failed attempt to get through a message because of this media. I mean, I'm screaming, but I'm at more danger of people who are in my own house than I am of these people that they're demonizing. But it wasn't cutting through, and I think it was media, too. So can you talk can you talk about the role of media in as a challenge? Because as you're saying, there's research to show that accommodating the far right on an issue like immigration, the unifying enemy of Europe's right, in this article you're writing, does nothing to tamper its rise and can even help it grow.
Yeah, I think the issue of media is definitely a very real one. I think that there are very powerful right-wing media ecosystems that are much more well-funded than left-wing media ecosystems, I guess is a short way to put it, that are able to sort of control narratives and get their message out. But I think there's also an unwillingness of, the sort of like center-left liberal media to be honest about what's going on, with people's cost of living, with immigration, with, the war in Gaza. And I think that people are frustrated with the things that are out there, with the media sources that are out there. And, I think you saw a lot of people turning to like podcasts in this last election that were pretty much not a contested field by the left here in America, where you saw Republican candidates going on these huge, you know, kind of bro-y podcasts. And I don't know. I mean, it's difficult to know whether that was a determining factor in the election. But I think, you know, engaging those spaces, but also putting in, you know, money and effort into developing left-wing media is more important than ever.
The agenda item, a tax the rich agenda, how is, can you tell us about how that's doing in places in Europe?
I can't tell you specifically about places in Europe. You know, it's something that I do follow, but not closely enough to tell you any specific legislation. I guess I can point you to a recent study in the U.S. that was an aggregation of polls by the Economic Wealth Disorder Institute that took, I think it was 55 national and state polls of a variety of wealth taxes, put all the numbers together and found that there is overwhelming support among the public, Republicans, Democrats, Independents, everyone for, you know, increasing how much taxes the wealthy pay as long as those taxes are going toward helping working class people. I think it's a popular position, and I think an important one in that building an agenda around that sort of wealth tax allows you to name the enemy, which I think is something that is deeply important, because when you don't name the enemy, it lets your opponents name the enemy. And in this election in the U.S. and in Europe, we're seeing the right name the enemy as immigrants, as transgender people, as other, you know, parts of society. Instead of pointing the finger directly at who we should be pointing it at, which is at, you know, billionaires, people that have extreme wealth and are wielding it to have an outsized influence in policy. So I think shifting, you know, focus toward wealth tax and being clear about who is stopping social progress would greatly benefit the left.
The places that you are looking at where you see agendas that are being that are more successful, that defy what seems like an inevitable turn to the far right. What kind of agendas? What are they doing that's making them successful? What are you seeing? Because I know you do keep an eye on that.
Yeah, I mean, it's difficult to find sort of like overarching consistencies among these administrations. I think one focus that's important, I think you see this in Mexico, I think you see this in Spain, I think you saw this among the sort of new left-wing coalition in France, is a focus and like a very, you know, explicit focus on working class people, on lifting up their concerns and on addressing their concerns. And not just, you know, having policy that might benefit them in the long term, but sort of, you know, saying it very clearly, this is policy meant to help the working class because we think that those are an important, you know, people to help that are suffering now. Instead of hand waving away, you know, real concerns people have about their salaries not keeping up with inflation, it's, you know, meeting them where they are, meeting the working class where they are, and saying we're here to help, and you know, we want to use the government as a positive tool to improve your living situations.
Chris Mills, Rodrigo is on the editorial team at inequality.org, the weekly newsletter that everyone should be following, and a managing editor of the newsletter. Chris, so, you know, when you talk about the center left, moving forward, what next on, the challenges presented by these gatekeepers, I guess you could call it.
Yeah, I mean, I think to sort of get back to your earlier point about my perspective as a young person, which I will now include, is that it has, I think, been somewhat frustrating to see the leaders of the Democratic Party here absolve themselves of responsibility after this election and not, you know, turn inward and consider why so many young people decided to stay home this election and to not, you know, bargain with the reality that they, you know, failed to deliver election results across the board, not just in the presidential race, but in the House and in the Senate as well. We also lost two Democratic trifectas in states. I think we're only down to 15 Democratic trifectas. So I think the challenge will be to accept that loss and not blame it on some, you know, external party, not blame it on, you know, wild leftist young people, to not blame it on misinformation, but to think about how you could start incorporating what makes people angry into your policy platforms, and maybe, you know, make some space for a new generation of leadership that has these, you know, ethical and moral positions at heart.
And I'll just add, we can't blame it on third parties either, right?
Absolutely not.
You know, it's, yeah. Oh, Chris, it's so great to talk with you. Chris Mails Rodrigo, look for anything he's thinking about, has written, moving forward, what you're writing. Chris, I can't wait to read it. Chris Mails Rodrigo from inequality.org. Thank you. Thank you so much. Here, we're going to start giving you all the keys. Not that I have any keys, but, you know, the folks there up there. Thank you so
appreciate
much.
It. Have a nice one.
You too. It's 8:33. We're going to take let's hear some music. I'm really enjoying the music. And then we're going to catch up with Dr. Clarence Lussain. Thank you.
A new world order, where we want, where we want. Brand new world. If you wanna see a brand new world, time to plant the seeds. Weeding out the seeds of hate, jealousy and greed. Said if you wanna see a brand new world, time to plant the seeds. Weeding out the seeds of hate, jealousy and greed. Why you why you why? So what I said, seeds of love will be planting in the four corners of this earth.
Build these best inside.
Well now, and the seeds of love will be growing, spreading all around. Sower me with your blessings, my God. Water it, water it. We're caring and sharing, nourish it, nourish it. With a little understanding, music is the tool. Well, well, planting the seeds of love in your mind.
Yeah.
Hoping and I'm praying we can spread love to mankind. Said if you wanna see a brand new world, time to plant the seeds. Weeding out the seeds of hate, jealousy and greed. Said if you wanna see a brand new world, time to plant the seeds of love. Weeding out the seeds of hate, jealousy and greed. Brand new world.
It is about 8:35. Thank you so much to Dr. Clarence Lussain standing by. I'm happy to welcome you back to The Buzz this morning. Dr. Lussain was with me day one after the election and today, 1 week later. Clarence Lussain is a professor of political science and is a director of the International Affairs Program at Howard University and an independent expert to the European Commission Against Racism and Intolerance, the author of many books, all of which you should read, but most recently, $20 and Change, Harriet Tubman, and the ongoing fight for racial justice and democracy, and also the Black history of the White House. Wanted to bring back Clarence Lussain today to talk more about pushing back on right-wing movements. Wanted to talk with you about white nationalism in the U.S. And in Europe. So good morning. And the partnership between white nationalists and the rich. Hey, good morning, Clarence Lussain. Thank you
good
for
morning.
Joining me.
Oh, I'm happy to.
Hey, so you know, before we kind of jump into some of those topics I just mentioned, You know, you are advisor to so many young people at Howard. What's your, you know, message that you've been giving them this past week about moving forward?
So I should just say that, you know, Howard probably was in a special situation, primarily because Vice President Harris graduated from Howard. So students felt kind of a particular bond. And then, of course, she's been back and forth to Howard. She was there prepping for her convention speech. She prepped for her debate with Donald Trump. And then on election night, headquarters was there at Howard. She did not come out and talk to the students and others who were waiting. But, you know, there was a lot of investment. So in the days after the election, you know, we were required to really engage with the students and help them through what had been a, you know, tremendous letdown. And remember, a lot of them were 18, 19, 20-year-olds. So these were this was their first time voting. And so, you know, they really just kind of stunned. But, you know, our message to them is that, you know, we have, you know, you take victories, you take losses, but you stay on mission. And that, you know, the values and the goals that, you know, they have, you know, are not derailed. You know, this was a setback in many ways because of, you know, who's coming into office. But, you know, they have to stay the course. You know, work through the grief, you know, don't pretend like it didn't hurt. But then, you know, you come out of that or you go, you know, you go forward.
Yeah, this, I think this connects with, builds on what you're saying there. I was looking back at an article you wrote last year on the rise of white nationalism alongside the second coming of Trump. And really, you know, to talk about like what this is, not pole punches. So, you know, the rise of white nationalism, I guess I'll just go to that article and you know, addressing that topic now today, post the election, where do you want to start on this topic?
So I've been using the term racial authoritarianism.
Racial authoritarianism, okay.
To bring together, you know, what has been a history of white supremacy and white nationalism and far-right fascist politics. So, for example, the term America First, which has been, you know, one of the themes of the Trump era, and there's American First Legal, which was started by Stephen Miller, which is basically to sue for racism against whites as he sees it. America First Policy Institute, which were, again, some of the former Trump people who were working on some of these far-right policies. But America First, as many people know, comes out of, in part, the 30s in the fascist pro-Hitler movement that existed. But prior to that, America First was actually articulated by the Ku Klux Klan. And so, you know, that history of those two extremist movements coming together, you know, has a long resonance in U.S. politics. What's different about it today is that it has evolved so that you have people of color. You have Latinos, you have African-Americans, you have Asians, very few of some Native Americans who are part of that movement. They kind of disavow the racial side of it or ignore it or are blind to it, but they certainly are binded with the rest of it. Part of it is this authoritarianism. Part of it is, as you hinted earlier, this Christian nationalism.
And, you know, I feel that we could, people are talking about the people of color and the men of color that are MAGA. Say more about what you think that really is. Are they really MAGA? And
Oh, indeed they are. There are definitely some. So as I've kind of stepped back over the last week and looked at the election, one of the things that's striking for me is that in the broader picture of things, it was not likely that Kamala Harris was going to resolve in 3 months what has actually been building over a number of years. And that's the rightward turn in American politics that actually has crossed racial lines, has crossed gender lines, has crossed regional lines. And what we saw in this last election was that even in so-called blue states, there was a further move to the right. So that's what's actually been unfolding. And so in that sense, then it's not unexpected that there would be African-Americans, African-American men and women who buy into the MAGA movement. Now, there are black people who supported Donald Trump for reasons of style and misbeliefs about his business abilities. And they weren't necessarily ideologically MAGA, but there are those who are, and they're organized. One of my critiques of where we're at right now is that the Democratic Party does not have the machinery to combat and address this populist right-wing MAGA moment. And so on the MAGA side, you've got a number of black organizations. You've got the Black Conservative Federation. You've got Blexit. You got the National Black Republican Association. You've got Black Voices for Trump. There are a number of organizations and groups that are well-funded in the millions of dollars that have been under the radar, I think, but they've been pushing and pushing and pushing. Now, Trump, I think, is not done nowhere near what he claims he has done in terms of black support. And in the swing states, I was going through the exit poll data, he actually did below the national average in terms of his black support. Nevertheless, there certainly are a number of African-Americans who I'm guessing will end up in his administration, probably one, I doubt two or more cabinet positions, but certainly sub-level cabinet positions, they will be there. So, but that's, again, tied to kind of a blind spot about the really sort of white nationalist underpinnings yes. Of MAGA.
I appreciate the direction you took that question in, because I don't think it's fair, or do you think it's fair to blame Black MAGAs for swinging this election?
Oh, not at all. Yeah. So I always move away from kind of the one bullet theory, that it's one group that, you know, is responsible for kind of a loss. And certainly I think, you know, if you look at, you know, the strongest supporters of Kamala Harris were black women, the second strongest were black men. So, you know, that just kind of doesn't fly. They're going to attempt to spin it along those lines, and they will front some black MAGA supporters, but that just kind of doesn't fit the facts. But I think the Democrats should pay clear attention that they have actually lost, you know, many, many kind of communities. And I would argue that the Democratic Party, as it's constructed now, just cannot meet this moment. And that if that generation of Pelosi and Obamas and Bidens, you know, their time is basically kind of passed.
Yes. I'm going to come back to that. But first, can you, what do you think Black MAGAs and the Ku Klux Klan members of MAGA have in common?
So I think there's a broad dissatisfaction with party politics. This is why in 2016, on the right, you had Donald Trump emerging from the outside, or perceived to be. You had Bernie Sanders emerging on the left in terms of the Democratic Party. The two parties have absolutely not met the interests of broad working people. Donald Trump's achievement was to be able to generate a brand that created the illusion that this was something different, that this was not the old Republican Party that was could no longer do what it said, and that it wasn't the Democratic Party. The Democrats have not been able to have a counter to that. And so you have a lot of people who really have been marginalized, who have been in many ways discarded, and they were looking for someone to step forward. I think it's notable that when you look at the last two Democratic presidents, they both were elected because the country was in crisis. Obama was elected in 2008 because the economy, again, was falling apart. The auto industry was failing and so forth. And then Biden was elected in 2020 because of the COVID crisis and, you know, a million people dying, businesses closing and so forth. But the trends have been the country moving further and further to the right because the right-wing populism of Donald Trump had a better sale than, I don't know what the Democrats were doing. But in any case, the Democrats were not. And I think, again, Kamala Harris, I think she made, you know, some mistakes along the way. But even if she had ran a perfect campaign, I don't think, I think the cake was baked. Certainly, there was no way in which Joe Biden was going to win. But even if there had been another more competent Democrat, if they had not broken from the Biden, Harris, and overall Democratic trend, it seemed to me it was just going to be really difficult. So going forward, it's not just a tweak here or there and let's find a better candidate. It really is a restructuring and reorientation of the Democratic Party that's needed, I think.
And you say Democrats can't match this MAGA movement. So, and you're talking about that now. So the opportunity here is in this rebuild and kind of pulling back the lens. You know, you are also an independent expert to the European Commission against racism and intolerance. We see this white nationalism that we're talking about spreading in Europe as well. So, you know, say more about what that party has to be then to match this MAGA movement.
So as you mentioned, it's a global trend. If you look at what happened in the UK, what happened in France, what happened in Italy, if you look at, you know, a number of places around the world, this far-right populism has arisen in part because global capital and its neoliberalist dimensions. By that I mean the attacks on social welfare programs, everything from healthcare systems to access to housing, education. All of that has become a basis for these movements that argue that they can do what these traditional parties cannot do. Now, they haven't delivered on that, and for the most part, they are another wing of capital, but it has sold. And if we look at the UK, for example, it wasn't that Labour soared. The Conservative Party, which had basically been in charge over the last 20 years or so, collapsed, and people just decided they were not coming out and support it. They weren't supporting Labour. They just did not. And what we saw here is that there's something like, I think, 9 million drop in the number of people who have voted this year versus 2020. And almost all of that is a collapse for the Democratic Party. And so, you know, these trends we're seeing kind of everywhere because the parties are not able to, are not demonstrating any ability to address the needs. I think one of the mistakes that the Harris campaign made was that it ceded territory on two key issues, immigration and inflation. And one of the kind of principles of political campaigning is that you go after your opponent's strengths, not their weaknesses. Weaknesses sort of are self-evident. But because the Democrats and Harris campaign and Biden did not effectively engage on those two critical issues that affects millions and millions of people in the country, it left it open for all of the banality and extremism, but resonance that we got from the Trump campaign. Now, I don't, you know, they're not going to do much on either one of those effectively, but the Democrats basically kind of gave up that territory.
And can you, could this have happened without this partnership with the ultra rich?
So this is a kind of layered phenomenon, because certainly prominent people like Elon Musk and Peter Thiel and J.D. Vance gave a very kind of visual support for billionaires for Donald Trump. But the Democrats absolutely tied to their billionaire. And, you know, Kamala Harris raised $1 billion. So, you know, the money that went into this campaign, you know, wasn't just kind of one-sided. And the question that, again, comes is, what's the expectation from the billionaires who have invested either in the Democrats or the Republicans? And those expectations are not, they're going to do right by the working class and by people who are in need. And so even, again, if, and this, the, you know, these were criticisms raised about Obama when he ran, that, you know, Wall Street got behind him and so forth. And then, you know, he ran a pretty moderate administration. And so with Kamala Harris, who in some sense moved away from Biden on that, although she did not explicitly say so. But, you know, it was really, to me, a, you know, billionaires kind of across the spectrum kind of campaign.
So a grassroots, I think, principled agenda for the people does not need rich people to win, right? Is that just too obvious to say or not?
Right. But, it, you know, it has to be an organized, immobilized, you know, constituency. I think at this point it's just not. And, you know, going forward, you know, as you kind of implied, that really has to be kind of upfront, and it can't be just, you know, look what we did and look at our numbers, and, you know, that's just not going to do it.
Are you worried about what will happen if this isn't successful, pushing back on the right wing? Are you worried?
I am absolutely worried. I think that we will get more and more extremist policies, and Donald Trump is kind of a populist, kind of along the lines of, you know, he wants to be Putin or Kim Jong-un. But J.D. Vance and others, we're talking Taliban. You know, yes. These are the folks who will institute, you know, a kind of cultural hegemony that, you know, we really have not seen. And they are really clear on this. But he's, at the moment, the heir apparent. So, you know, we should really be concerned. I cannot tell you, maybe you can, you know, who's the leader of the Democratic Party right now?
Yes. Clarence, listen, you are a professor, so you are a teacher. You know how important the questions are. So right now, have you begun to just tell us what questions you're formulating in your mind that you want to know the answers to? Like, who's the leader of the Democratic Party now?
Right. So that's one question. So to me, it really is. So given the results of this election, how will the Democrats move forward in their assessment? How will the left move forward in its assessment? And I think it means getting beyond just focusing on the misogyny and the racism that are there, and, you know, are not necessarily going away, but digging deeper into, you know, how do you build a counter to MAGA that is not tied to the old systems of the Democratic Party? I don't think there's easy answers. And it's not clear, you know, where that emerges from. Maybe the last sense of that might even always go all the way back to the Jackson campaigns in the 1980s. But we haven't seen, you know, much like that since. You know, Bernie, when he ran, you know, first of all, Bernie hadn't, you know, wasn't a Democrat. And then Bernie also did not put energy into trying to build, you know, an alternative movement that would be working inside and outside. And then I haven't seen that from some of the AOCs and others that have come along. So how that happens is really critical, because, again, when I look around the world, that's the struggle that everybody, I think, is having. You know, how do you come up with, how do you combat these populist movements that are not the old fascist movements that we think of from like the 1930s, where, you know, they just kind of came in with the tanks and, you know, built camps and did all of that. But they're no less extreme. And will the extremism initiate these kinds of movements, you know, when you know, they send in the troops to start raiding to deport people? You know, how will we react to that? Because they're going to go as far as they can. And so we shouldn't have any illusions that, you know, that they're going to moderate. Trump thinks he has a mandate. This is his last shot. He can't run again. He can't change the Constitution. So, you know, he's going to try to do everything he can, and the people around him are going to try to do everything they can.
Yes. To take that worry and turn it into principled action. Hey, I am right. So glad to talk with you. Dr. Clarence Lussain, professor of political science and director of the International Affairs Program at Howard University and an independent expert to the European Commission Against Racism and Intolerance. He's author of many books and articles. Read anything he writes. Thank you, Clarence, for joining me. It was just great to have you.
Thank you. Have a good day.
Take care. Hey, thank you for tuning in this morning. I think we're almost to the top of the hour. I'm Jan Miyasaki. Thank you to John Aminer, our music producer and engineer. And I'll talk with you next week.
You're listening to WRT 89.9 FM in Madison, Wisconsin.
This is the Insurgent Radio Kiosk for Wednesday, November 13th.
Even in a barrel full of rotten apples, you might think there'd still be a few good ones. But don't get your hopes up looking into barrels labeled private equity investors. These esoteric multi-billion dollar Wall Street schemes rig the marketplace so, quote, high net worth individuals can grab fat profits and special tax breaks to buy up doctor's offices, hometown newspapers, childcare centers, etc. Consider America's humble but beneficial mobile home parks. Home ownership has become so pricey that these affordable manufactured units now make up 10% of all single-family home sales. But while the buyers own the houses, they must rent lots from mobile park owners. This has generally been a square deal when park owners live among the renters, providing decent services at reasonable rates. One such is Lynnhaven Center, with some 300 mobile homes in Brunswick, Maine. But what is home to millions of people has become a quick buck target for Wall Street's equity profiteers. Waving cash at longtime trailer park owners, they've been snatching up thousands of these lots. Without warning, people's home places are being bought out from under them. The absentee predators then raise rents to drive out residents, clearing the spaces for high-dollar renters or buyers. This is Jim Hightower saying, but wait, good news for a change. A new law in Maine gives mobile home residents a